brilliant Middle Eastern and geopolitic analysis. I acknowledge all your remarks. I have a question. The threat of Iran becoming nuclear is very high. What is the plan of Israel? Military attack, and if so, with U.S. green light or without green light of the United States? And second, if there is a new geopolitical competition, on one side PRC, Russia, and Iran, and on the other side the United States, maybe the European Union and Israel. At the same time, the PRC has very close relations now with Saudi Arabia. How can one explain this this balance of power which is happening right now in the Middle East region and beyond?
Yes, thank you for that. An excellent two questions. So first of all, with regard to the nuclear issue, I mean, of course, we don't know about timing and details, but actually we do know about the intentions of Israel in this regard, because they're clearly stated, also by Prime Minister Netanyahu and also by a bunch of current and former senior security officials. And it is clearly stated that if Israel believes that the Iranians are beginning to make a final push towards testing a nuclear weapon, there will be military action to prevent that. And my own sense, at least, from Netanyahu has not said this, but senior former, particular one individual, which is Yaakov Amidor, who I've met a few times, who is a former national security advisor of Netanyahu, and closely linked to him, we can say, has said on the record that Israel, if it needs to, can go alone. He said that it would be preferable, of course, to go with American support, but if needed, necessary, Israel can do it alone. So we have clear statements from both serving and former officials regarding Israel's intention in that regard. Now, it's interesting that Israel's red line, and this is worth stating because we're not doing PR here, right? Israel's red line has shifted actually significantly, i.e. the point at which military action is supposed to take place. If you listen to Benjamin Netanyahu speaking back in 2012, Israel used to say that 250 kilograms of uranium enriched to 20% or more will be the red line for Israel. Well, the Iranians crossed that red line, you know, years ago, right? And no such action has taken place. So the sense now is that the red line is pretty much as far to nuclear capacity as it could possibly be. The Iranians, according at least to recent news reports, have already enriched uranium to 84%. 90% is the level you need to get for a weapon. A Defense Department official called Colin Carl was on record today as saying, in his view at least, the Iranians need about 12 days to get to 90% if they chose to do so. So the sense is that today the red line is about as close as you can get to actually achieving the nuclear capacity, but then action will be taken, and I think we should take that very seriously. I think this is something which is regarded as an existential matter from Israel's point of view, and in my opinion as an Israeli citizen, let me say correctly so. With regard to PRC and Saudi Arabia and so on, it's an interesting question, and as I think you know, and maybe others know or be interested to learn, the Chinese have been critical also recently of the Iranian regime and of its regional adventurism. And they've given hints that, you know, this should stop. This is not what the Chinese are looking for. Everyone who deals with the Chinese knows that the first thing they will tell you is that what China wants is stability. Right? The Chinese don't care what your ideology is. They don't care how repressive you are internally. But they do care, can you keep order? They don't like dealing with uncertainty and with conflict. They want strong, powerful, centralized regimes to deal with. That's not what the Iranians want, right? If you think of what I've been talking about in terms of Iranian activity, what it produces is not strong centralized government. It produces weak and collapsed states in which the only strong thing is the IRGC. Yeah? The Iranians kind of insert their own deep state into other countries, and then the official state becomes empty and hollow shell. This is not a natural partner for what the Chinese would try to do. They're trying to build trade routes. They're trying to build ports. They're trying to build railways. The Middle East is very important for them because if you want to bring goods from South China coast through to the Mediterranean, you have to come through the waterways of the Middle East. They don't want to have guerrilla fighters and crazy people at every single port. It's not what the Chinese want. So absolutely, you're right. This is a very complex situation. And correctly, as you said, Saudi Arabia is the main supplier of oil to China, and China is an oil-vulnerable power, if I can put it that way. It doesn't have its own oil. So this is a very important strategic relationship for China, which the Iranians can't be a substitute for. So absolutely right. There are huge question marks remaining about the whole issue of the Chinese. It's not that they fit happily and comfortably into a counter-Western global alliance with a clear and united agenda. There's nothing like that. It's a much more confused and complex space with which we are dealing. But there are some indications, nevertheless, of movement in the direction, potentially, of a greater linkage between China, Russia, and Iran. And this is something we need to be watching very closely. I wouldn't say anything more than that, just we need to be watching the space very closely.
Thank you. The next question was here, and then you come next.
Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. I have two questions. You have pointed out a new Cold War. There are two camps, and even if they have internal ideological splits, they largely stick together. What I don't understand is why in this Cold War scenario, which is not only the Middle East, but now also China, Russia, and the West on the other side, Iran, from the Western perspective, is somehow still taken out. No? You can read everywhere about Russia, China, and Iran is not even mentioned. When Iran is getting closer and closer, and you called it a senior partner on a weapons level to Russia now, we don't know why certain things are done or not done, but still in the background there is, we want a new JCPOA.
Yeah.
When this JCPOA is expiring already, because the sunset clauses are getting nearer, and then, okay, let's assume a JCPOA would be possible. This would mean hundreds of billions of cash to Iran, which would make it possible for Iran to supply Russia with new arms. And sure. It doesn't make any sense for me. So why is Iran, from your perspective, somehow taken out from this Cold War scenario?
Yes.
From a Western side? And my second question is, do you see any impact of this now nearly half a year uprising in Iran on the expansionism or on the possibility of expansionism of the Iranian regime?
Thanks for that. Let me just say, because I didn't say it at the beginning, that I'm very happy if people want to also make comments and not only questions. I'm happy that you did that, because I want it to be interesting for me as well, and I'm tired of the sound of my own voice, but also because it can generally be more productive if people are also not only asking a question, but saying, well, actually, I thought you maybe forgot this, or what about that? This is more interesting. So thank you for that. And with regard to the question, when I want to be extremely cynical, and forgive me for being extremely cynical for a moment, in answer to this question, why have they generally been left out? I say it's because white lives matter, right? What do I mean by white lives matter? I mean that when they began to mess around with Ukraine, all of a sudden, for some reason, everybody began to listen to why Iran was a problem. When it was just us and the Emiratis talking about it, then, you Middle Easterners want to come and trouble us with your nonsense and try and pull us into your shenanigans. I used to hear this a lot from friends, colleagues, diplomats from Britain, from France, other European embassies in Israel and elsewhere, in Iraq also, when I lived there for a while. Over the years, because I've been doing this stuff for a while, where I would talk about IRGC, for example, and the nature of it as a global agent of subversion and disorder. And the colleague would answer something like the following. They would say, look, we understand why you as an Israeli have a real problem with the Iranians. You really do. They are a challenge to you and you have a real problem. And we understand why you want to make it into our problem as well. And actually, if I was an Israeli, the person would say, I would do the same. It's understandable. But come on, between us, be serious. You know that they're not a challenge. We Europeans, let's say, have a problem with Sunni political Islam, with Salafi jihadis, with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS. These are real urgent problems. This is 5, 6, 7 years ago, right? You remember those days, yeah? But the Shia, the Iranians, come on, be serious. You don't hear that so much anymore, or hardly at all. in conversations with colleagues. I would say that the events of recent years have, to some degree, I agree with you, they're still left out, but less so than they were before. This door has opened to a degree. I do think that the Ukraine war, and understandably so, I was just joking about the other, of course, understandably, now it's in Europe. There's a reason why it's more urgent for Westerners to take it seriously. And they are doing more so. The other reason why I think Iran is less left out now than it was 5-6 years ago is because over the last, we're now 2023, so over the last 8 years, since 2015, there is emerging increasing evidence of IRGC and other Iranian state bodies supported terrorism on European soil. Right? We think about, we can list it, I mean, the killing of two senior Iranian opposition leaders, one Arab and one Baloch, in the Netherlands, one in 2015, one in 2017. In 2018, Iranian Danish citizen arrested in Copenhagen for scouting out the home of an Iranian opposition leader with intent of assassination. In 2015, ammonium nitrate discovered in a house in North London linked to Lebanese Hezbollah. And just a week ago, the Iran International, the well-known Iranian opposition news channel, moving from London to Washington because the British authorities said they can't guarantee the safety and security of these people. And the head of MI5, British Internal Security, Mr. McCallum, going on the record as saying that his service has defeated or frustrated no less than 10 Iranian planned terrorist acts in Britain over the last year, just in the course of 2022. So it means this is an additional matter which has a little bit, I think, changed the discussion as well. I read a fascinating article recently. I'd forgotten about this fact, which recalled that in, I think, 2018, when Mike Pompeo became Secretary of State in America, in his first speech, and when I read it, I remembered this. In his first speech, Pompeo made this comment in one sentence that, like, the Iranians are committing acts of terror all over Europe. This was in 2018. And there was a huge amount of media coverage. People said, what's he talking about? Where does he get this? Which acts of terror? And the Guardian, I read it in the Guardian. The Guardian, of course, went out and spoke to the Iranian experts at the think tanks in London and said, what do you know about this? And they all said, no, as far as we are aware, the last ones were, I think, in Berlin, if I'm not mistaken, in the early 90s, at a restaurant where they killed some Kurdish leaders and then some other cases. One of the Iranian guys was smart enough to say the kind of obvious fact, which was, of course, I assume that Pompeo has sources of information which I don't have from Chatham House in London. As it turns out, he did, and now we know what was going on. So I do think that a door is opening, and this is beginning to change, but I agree that we've still got a very long way to go. I think it is changing, though. Regarding the revolution, or the uprising in Iran, yeah, I think it's, first of all, I think it's very, very significant indeed. I did a research project to northern Iraq, to the border area in November with colleagues, because there is a kind of line over the mountains for young Iranians who took part in the demonstrations and then were identified by the authorities. Many of them escaped across the mountains to northern Iraq, Kurdish northern Iraq. So we went there to try to interview young people who had just arrived. It was a fascinating project. We interviewed many, many young people. And the impression we got from that, and of course just from reading media as we all do, was that this is a very, very serious uprising indeed. 5 months in, it's still continuing, not given sufficient media coverage, but all the way across Iran, not only Kurdistan and Balochistan, but also Tehran and Isfahan, yeah, all the way across the country, young people, not only the young women who bravely led it at the beginning, but a much broader section of population now in terms of age and other, you know, in every aspect. And it's not going anywhere. And it is about not only hijab, but it's about the regime. It is a challenge to the authority openly of the regime. Very, very significant indeed. To what extent does it impact? Does it impact Iranian expansionism? Well, the problem is that currently it does not, simply because what we see also through the times of real sanctions against this regime, is that the regime has the expansionist program ring-fenced, so to speak. No matter what else is happening, no matter if there isn't money for other stuff, there will always be money for that. Partly because the militias are to some degree self-financing, because, for example, the Iraqi Shia militias, Iraq is a very rich country, of course, in terms of its natural resources, Iraqi Shia militias have access to oil fields, so they can partly finance themselves. They don't only need the handouts from Tehran. But in any case, the regime always finds money for the expansionism. So in the short term, it doesn't impact, I think. In the longer term, clearly it does, because I think this uprising genuinely challenges the future of the regime in Tehran. And from this point of view, you bring down the regime in Tehran. Of course, you solve every other problem. Ktaib Hezbollah and Hezbollah are not going to bother you anymore once the IGC no longer exists. Yeah. So in the longer term, I think it's very significant. Of course, then the final point is, what kind of long term? What are we talking about here? Can't predict that, of course. But a good friend of mine who I interviewed also in northern Iraq, she's one of the leaders of one of the veteran Iranian Kurdish organizations, Komala, it's probably familiar to some of the Iranian people here. And she said a very interesting point to me. She said, look, people are talking about, oh, it's been going on for 2 months, but the regime is still there. She reminded me that, you know, the agitation that eventually led to the fall of the Shah in 1979 continued for maybe a year and a half prior to his fall. It was a long campaign that ended with him falling. So, in her opinion, we are already into something similar to that process. We will see. But in any case, it's already deeply significant, I think. So.
Thank you. There was a question there. Afterwards,
thank you so much.
Sure.
The intention of governance is one thing of politics, but on the other hand, you have populations and their living situation.
Yeah.
There's an earthquake, there's a lack of water in extreme forms we never have had before in Iraq and in Syria too, and you have a lack of nutrition in Syria, in Egypt. How does it influence your analysis on all this?
Yeah. Thank you for this question. First of all, without any question, environmental issues impact very strongly on these matters. And I'll give you an example, which is a common one, but it's a very important one. One way of tracing the emergence of the Syrian insurgency is back to the very serious drought which hit northern Syria a year and 2 years prior to the outbreak of the revolution, because what the drought produced was it drove farming families off their land, and then they formed what we would call in English shanty towns, if this term is familiar to people, these sort of semi-refugee towns around the cities. And I can tell you, as a journalist who covered the Syrian revolution in its early stages, these places were where the fighters came from for the insurgency. The fighters were not sons and daughters of wealthy, you know, middle-class families from Aleppo, from Sunni Aleppo. They were from these towns around these frustrated shanty towns around the city. So undoubtedly the drought plays a very, very important role in this. It's only one example, and there are many others. Yeah, the environment, apart from the fact that environmental issues are important intrinsically, but they're also important in terms of impacting on political events. So yeah, absolutely we have to pay attention from that point of view. More broadly, and it's good that you asked this question because of lack of time, I didn't really have a chance to go into this, but I really want to. Yeah, more broadly, it's very important to note that the two power blocks that I was talking about have one thing in common. Israel is maybe an exception, but broadly they have one thing in common, which is that all the players on both sides, except Israel, operate and govern without the consent of their populations. Right? This is, of course, true of Islamic Republic of Iran, Assad, and Hashd-Shaabi, and Hezbollah in Lebanon, obviously. But it's also true, of course, of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and so on. These are not elected governments. They are authoritarian rulers. So another interesting way to look at our region, and I wish I had a map here because you can trace it very interestingly on the map, is that there is one massive absence from that whole description. And it is the group of people who are, in fact, still the majority community in the Middle East, and that is Arabic-speaking Sunni Muslims. This is still most of the people in our region, but they're not represented, obviously not by the Iranians, who are a gathering of non-Sunni forces, essentially, but also not by the other group, which, again, apart from Israel, which, of course, is not an Arab state, the other members are authoritarian Arab rulers. So one way of looking at the events of the region of the last 10 years, a different way to the way that I did it, but an equally valid way, is to say that all the way from Iraq down to Egypt, in a kind of crescent of countries, like from Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Israel, Palestinian territories, and Egypt, in all those areas, the Sunni Arab population, sometimes a majority, like in Syria, sometimes a minority, like in Iraq, but the Sunni Arab population has tried to introduce a political project of its own, and this political project has been completely defeated. These populations have been defeated all the way along that crescent. If we think about the projects for a moment. Well, in Egypt, the project was Muslim Brotherhood government, right? We don't like it, but this was what people actually voted for when they had the chance to vote in 2011. And then the army brought it down in 2013. In Israel, well, we have the Second Intifada, right? We have the desire of Palestinians to defeat Israel militarily, which was completely crushed and was a failure. In Lebanon, the Sunnis are crushed under the weight. The Sunni movement was March 14th movement of the Hariris, right? This reform, pro-Western reform movement, which, of course, in the summer events of 2008, was completely crushed by Hezbollah. In Syria, it goes without saying, the insurgency, which was completely defeated by Assad. Further east into Iraq, it was the Islamic State, actually. Of course, we don't like the Islamic State, but the point about Islamic State was it didn't come from out of the sky. Huh? It came from the local political culture of Sunni Arabs. And one thing we can say about it, maybe thankfully, it was completely crushed and defeated. So all the way along that crescent, actually the desire of the people, or at least of a very significant section of the people, has been completely frustrated and crushed. In some cases, we're glad, probably, or at least I am glad that it was crushed, because if the desire of the people is the Muslim Brotherhood or Islamic State, I'm sorry, I'm happy when their desire is frustrated, yeah? In other cases, like with the Hariris or the Syrian insurgency, it's a more complex picture. But yes, absolutely, the issue of popular sentiment and popular will, we should absolutely include in these analyses, not because we're trying to be charitable, but because we would be foolish to ignore it. Because, of course, we can assume that the Sunnis may be defeated for now. It doesn't mean they're going to be defeated forever. They haven't gone anywhere. There are still massive populations of young Arabic-speaking Sunni Muslims in all the countries that I mentioned, and they will certainly be making their political voice heard in the period ahead. So we shouldn't forget it. So it's a good question you asked, also because this is a part of the picture which needs to be there, which I hadn't had time to discuss. So thank you.
Thank you. Next question was from Rebecca. Please a little bit louder because you're sitting in the back.
Mm-hmm. So that is one comment. And my question is, where do you see Qatar? Where do you see Qatar going in the whole picture?
Yeah, sure. First of all, with regard to the comment, absolutely right. And I mean, I didn't mention it in any detail, but there are many indications of the prior existing close relationship, you know, prior to February 2022. You mentioned some important ones from a Middle Eastern point of view. You only have to look at the ordnance, at the forms of weaponry which the organizations which are fighting Israel, for example, use, and then you will understand very quickly this pre-existing relationship. In the 2006 war in Lebanon, famously, Israeli armor, Israeli tanks, you know, suffered a certain number of losses from a missile system that the Hezbollah were using. What was the system? It's the Cornet system, Cornet ATTM. Anti-tank guided missile system. It's not produced in the Dahia in South Beirut, huh? And not in Tehran either. It's a Russian system, of course. Now, you know, Israeli diplomats who unfortunately, or maybe inevitably, are well versed in the habit of saying that it's raining when actually something else is kind of liquid is coming down on them. I won't be vulgar and go into the details. Right, when they're confronted with this question, would say, well, we ask our Russian colleagues about this, and the Russians say, well, we didn't sell it to Hezbollah, so we have no idea. It's our system. We didn't give it to them, so it's not our fault if your guys are getting killed by Russian anti-tank guided missiles in Marjayoun and El Khayyam. And the answer is, of course, they sell it to Iran or to Bashar Assad, and Assad hands it on to Hezbollah. So, yeah, of course, the outlines of this relationship have been there for a long time. What we're now seeing is a solidification of prior existing patterns, not something which is completely new. Absolutely. With regard to Qatar, again, this is a good and very useful question because this is the other or one of the two other bits which I didn't mention because of lack of time. Had we been having this discussion here, where are we now, 2023, 10 years ago, I would have, I or any other analyst worth their profession, would have spent a great deal of time on Qatar and on Turkey and on the Muslim Brotherhood and Sunni political Islam, because then it looked like that was going to be a big part of the future of the region, right? Came to power in Egypt, came to power in Tunisia, nearly came to power in Syria, and so on. That moment has long since passed now. You know, that moment was brief, very intense, but very brief. Today, Muslim Brotherhood is very, very weak across the region. Qatar is still there, of course. Al Jazeera is still there. It's still making noise. But the role they were having, the really central role, where they were punching really above their weight 10 years ago, is no longer the case, because it was dependent on these Sunni radical movements, and they are very much weakened now. Where does that leave Qatar? Look, the Qataris are still very smart and sharp operators, as we know, because they successfully, subsequent to that period, in 2015, 16, 17, successfully defeated an attempt by the Saudis and Emiratis to completely marginalize them and destroy their relationship with the Americans, remember? And actually, people like Jim Mattis and others saved them, and that didn't happen. They came through that difficult period when at one time people were even saying maybe they could be invaded. You know, it was, sounds funny now. People were talking that way. They came through it very well, very smartly. So they remain a very significant player. But today, I would say the Qataris are playing a bit of a different role. And maybe it's a more sensible role for them than trying to foment revolutions in every country except for their own, of course, maintaining a dictatorship at home and making everyone else have revolutions, which they were doing 10 years ago. Now what they're trying to do is mediate. The advantage which they have, such as it is because they talk to radicals and at the same time they are in fact dependent on the United States. It means they have lines of communication to everybody. And as a result, they're making themselves useful as a diplomatic mediator in all kinds of contexts. We know where the deal between the Americans and the Taliban, for example, was conducted. They went to Doha. They didn't just choose it randomly on the map. They did it because the Qataris have long allowed Taliban to maintain a representative office in Doha. And, of course, the Al Udeid air base is there as well, so the Americans can get there easily, let's say. Yeah. Same with, for example, Israel's relations with Hamas enclave in Gaza. Officially speaking, of course, Israel and Hamas enclave in Gaza are in a state of conflict. But in reality, they are in a state of conflict, but parallel to the conflict, Israel does not want the Hamas enclave in Gaza to collapse, because if it collapsed, the complete Somalia-style chaos which would result would be worse than the Hamas rule. So therefore, Israel, via the mediation of Qatar, allows for injections of cash to be coming in on a weekly basis, millions of dollars coming in on a weekly basis to Hamas in Gaza to allow them to stay in control. So this is the kind of role Qatar is currently playing. They are mediating between everybody, in their view, making themselves useful. Maybe they even are making themselves useful. And there it is. So they have passed their highest point of influence, I would say, which was the Arab Spring. When the Arab Spring was happening and Al Jazeera was, you know, fanning the flames of Islamist revolt across the region, they were at the height of influence. Now they're somewhere lower, more appropriate to their size, and this is how I would characterize it.
You're an excellent, but I have, give me a second. I have a question. You were describing the two blocks, the Iranian bloc and the other bloc. And I remembered 1.5 or 2 years ago, you wrote an article that the consisted of this other bloc, Israel and the Gulf states and the Kurdish people, and isn't quite functioning, or you were skeptical, you were writing, if this on the long term gets closer, or this dissolves somehow and spreads away. So what is your momentary assessment of that blog? Is it still that diverse, or is are the dots getting together?
I think it's getting together. And I mean, I mentioned it, I think, in the talk, and I'm happy to reiterate that point or strengthen that point. As a result of Abraham Accords, as a result of such bodies as I2U2, MEAD, which is Middle East Air Defense Alliance, Negev Summit, and so on, and as a result of the empirical evidence we read about now of presence of Israeli air defense material in UAE, which I assume is only the tip of what is really there, I think there's plenty of evidence to show that this alliance has got much stronger in the course of the last 2 years. I mean, frankly, 2 years ago, you know, I think 2 years ago, probably I and many others as well would have taken issue with the very use of the word alliance for this group. Or we would have said something like, words are supposed to have meanings, right? Otherwise, why do we bother with them, yeah? If we want to use the word alliance to mean what the Iranians have, and that's how we define alliance, then we shouldn't really be using it to describe this other thing because it's much more amorphous. Today, I would say it has gone some considerable way towards solidifying itself, but nevertheless, we should not become simplistic and too straightforward, because we know, for example, that United Arab Emirates, at the same time that it is buying Israeli air defense equipment, is doing its very best to rebuild diplomatic relations with Tehran. Right? So there is a, you know, there are complexities here which we mustn't miss also.
Thank you. Please.
Only for short, there was a very concerning news in the morning. Absolutely, you have now. You have heard it. It should be so that Iran is only 12 days removed from the building of its new bomb.
Yes.
So, as everybody should know, Israel is strong enough and should be independent of the United States to make a preemptive strike to overcome and to survive, yes? So have you really the support of the Abraham Accord states in this regard? What are the problems? And on the other hand, you have a lot of trouble with your inner country movements coming from the Arabs and so on. And yes, it's really very, very difficult to handle this situation for your survival. What in your regard will you think will act Europe and so on? Do you really mean there is an outcry in Europe over this preemptive strike? I have some doubts, but I think the way is clear. You have to survive and you have to make your preemptive strike.
Yeah, well, I think that this is coming close. First of all, with regard to the 12-day issue, just we need to clarify this, or just to focus on it for a moment. This was the statement made by the U.S. Defense Department official, his name, Colin Carl, if I'm not mistaken. Of course, what he was saying was that they would take them about 12 days to get sufficient fissile material for a nuclear device. It would then take some additional time for them to weaponize that fissile material, to put it on a warhead which they can launch. As to how long that would take, well, we don't really know. The official Israeli position is that this would take an additional 2 years. But, of course, that is based on the information that we know or that our government knows about the state of Iran's missile capacities. But what we also know about Iran from previous experience is that much of what they are up to, we don't necessarily know about. Back to the days of good old Donald Rumsfeld, if you remember him, and what he used to call the unknown unknowns. We don't know what we don't know, right? So we don't know. We know from when the Mossad stole this nuclear archive, which went back to 2003, the archive, I mean, they stole it much later, of course. The archive shows that prior to 2003, the Iranians were concealing large parts of what their activity was. Let's say at that time, we didn't know what they were doing. It's possible now we don't know what they're doing either. So when we say 2 years, we are being a bit optimistic. We're saying, we're assuming that we know exactly what they're up to. It could be 1 year, it could be 6 months, it could be less. I assume that our intelligence knows, well, I hope at least, that our intelligence knows more of what is going on, sufficient that we'll know when it is time to act, if the choice is between acting or accepting a nuclear Iran. I do believe that there will be a preemptive strike if that moment comes. Of course, it's possible that it won't come, because it's possible that the Iranians will prefer to remain a threshold nuclear power, which they are already today, rather than to make this final sprint, and then it won't happen. But if they make that decision, and Israel knows about it, I think that a preemptive strike will come. I assume that the European Union may well not openly support such a strike. Okay, but they very much did not support Israel's destruction of Saddam Hussein's nuclear capacity in 1981, or Bashar Assad's nuclear capacity in 2007, and nevertheless, they and the rest of the world benefited enormously from both of these actions of Israeli air power, without wishing to begin to sound like I'm giving a nationalistic speech. I'm not, but this is verifiable fact, and it will probably be the same way around again if Israel has to act preemptively.
From the Abraham Accord?
Oh, excuse me, you mentioned this. Yeah, Look, there was recently this, just a few weeks ago, there was this exercise, Juniper Oak, which was the very big exercise of Israel with US CENTCOM. And clearly this exercise was sending a message to Iran. If we look at the things which were exercised, such as, for example, mid-air refueling of bomber aircraft, and so there was B-52s involved. It was a very large-scale exercise. I think, although I don't have, I can't prove this, I think that any such air action against Iranian nuclear facilities, unlike Oz Iraq in 1981 and Kaibar facility in 2007, will not be like a single action taken by one squadron of F-35s, which will take off in the morning and be back in Tel Aviv in time for lunch. Yeah? It won't be like that. It will be, because of the nature of the Iranian project, spread out and sophisticated. It will be an ongoing, very large-scale air action, which will take hours and maybe days and maybe more to complete. So in that situation, the possession of alliances with such countries as United Arab Emirates to the south, I mentioned also Azerbaijan to the north, which I would mention once again, these will be very, very important. And Abraham Accords is about UAE, of course, and the less visible but very notable close relations in Israel and Azerbaijan to the north is part of the same equation.
I get two questions. Are this the last one, or is anybody else wanting to ask another question? These two people are the last question.
Just a short question I would like to ask before your opinion about the role of Turkey. Mm-hmm. If you could say some more words about it in regard of Turkey's connection to Syria, to Russia, to Ukraine, to Israel, of course.
Sure. Yes, so with regard to Turkey, which again was in a way maybe the last missing piece of the jigsaw that I'd not discussed, so it's very useful. Again, had we been having the discussion here 10 years ago, we would have spent a great deal of time talking about Turkey, because Turkey, apart from Qatar, was the other country that was hoping to ride this wave of success of Sunni conservative political Islam in Syria, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and so on and so forth. That wave has largely broken, of course. So what are the Turks currently up to? As far as I can see, what the Turks are up to is that they have some new foreign policy. The foreign policy officially that they have is called No Problems with Neighbors, right? You're probably familiar with. This is the official slogan of Erdogan's foreign policy, No Problems with Neighbors. What, in fact, I think Erdogan is doing is he's blackmailing all his neighbors. Right? What Turkish foreign policy really is it's blackmail all your neighbors. What do I mean by this? Well, with regard to you as Europeans, you know very well the style of Erdogan's blackmail. What he does is when you don't give him what he wants, he says, listen, I've got 3.65 million potential refugees in Turkey. Do you want to meet them? If you don't want to meet them, think about giving me what I'm looking for. This is Turkey's blackmail style with regard to Europe. But also he has a blackmail style with regard to Israel, which I'm sorry to say Israel appears willing to go along with. What he says with regard to Israel is, okay, I'm going to domicile some of the most dangerous terrorist organizations that making war on you. Hamas has its office in Istanbul. And parallel to that, I want to have nice relations with you. I want to have like a protection racket, like someone comes around to your shop and says, I'm keeping order in your shop because bad people are out there and give me money, otherwise something bad could happen. Erdogan to Israel says, Hamas is going to live with me. They're not going anywhere. I'm not expelling them. I don't care how much you want that. And at the same time, if you want normality with us, you can have it. We can have nice relations. And that even includes, by the way, and this is a true thing which happened, not just propaganda, sometimes when Israelis are in danger from other terrorist organizations on Turkish soil, the Turkish authorities cooperate very well with Israeli authorities to help Israeli civilians. So Erdogan at the same time is helping Israelis escape from terrorism and supporting terrorist organizations that are fighting Israel. So this is the policy of blackmail. Same thing with regard to UAE. Of course, he's reviving relations with UAE, but at the same time, he's still supporting Muslim Brotherhood on a regional level, which the Emiratis are terrified of, and so on and so forth. Even to some degree, I think he's doing the same with Russia, in terms of what he's doing with Russia. On the one hand, he's supporting the Ukrainian war effort. It is Turkish drones, which are the ones that the Ukrainians are finding. But at the same time, he's also seeking to cooperate very, very closely with the Russians as best he can. For example, he's issuing this very strange refusal to allow Sweden to have an easy path into NATO membership as one of the ways in which he can use his leverage on behalf of Russia to keep NATO weak and to make problems for NATO. So it's problems and blackmail with everyone. This is what he's doing. Is it working? Yeah, actually, unfortunately, it's working pretty well. As of now, right, he's not doing so badly at all. Prior to this earthquake, I think he was looking very well set to be re-elected in May and in June. He might still be re-elected in May and June, simply because he has read the remark by the late Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin, who said that what's important is not who votes, what's important is who counts the vote. Right? He or everyone also knows this, so he might still nevertheless be re-elected, but we shall have to wait and see. Fascinating last piece of the picture is that economically he was doing very badly up until recently, but now the economy over the last year has largely turned the corner. He's doing okay. So he already sees improving. The currency is no longer devaluing and so on. So Erdogan, I think, looks quite well set to make it through. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we're talking about Erdogan this time next year, in spite of the earthquake and all the other things that have just taken place.
So, thank you so much. Last question.
Mr. Spire, I have one short question. Is the Iranian atomic capacity deterrence for Iran and balance of power towards Iran, or is it really the aim of destruction of Israel?
Right. Yeah, thank you for this. Well, I have always been of the opinion, and I remain of the opinion, that the Iranian regime is not delusional. I mean, it is extremely ideological and extremely ambitious. And I think that the Iranian regime, the Iranian leaders, when they talk about the destruction of Israel, I think that they are serious. It is a strategic goal of Iran. But certainly from what they say, they don't mean that it will be destroyed by a nuclear device landing in Tel Aviv or something. They have this idea, you're familiar with this, of course, I mean, they have this idea that Israel is a very weak country behind its apparent strength, and that therefore if you continually support military and political organizations acting against Israel, eventually the society will become weak and begin to crumble, and through this process Israel will kind of fade away into nothingness. It's a silly idea because they never met an Israeli, so they don't know how wrong this is, but never mind, this is what they think. Now, this remains my view, and therefore what it means, as I said before, and as we I think agree, the Iranian regime is seeking a bid for hegemony in the region, westwards toward the Mediterranean, southwards towards the Gulf. It's a little bit like, if we can make a historical comparison in this gathering, which everybody will understand, it's a little bit like Wilhelmine Germany, in a sense, prior to World War I, when, you know, the big European colonial powers, Britain and France, already existed, had parceled out the world. Germany was only just unified, came late to the party. So German colonial ambitions, even though they were only the same as those of Britain or France, were inherently disruptive. The status quo had to be disturbed by German ambitions because Germany was a new player on the block. What Iran is trying to do in this region, in our region rather, inevitably disturbs the status quo. It is an immensely big ambition, and therefore, inevitably, it requires that you go up against and confront the existing status quo. If you want to do that, it is natural that you should want to have a very strong insurance policy to make sure that the enemy cannot simply destroy you. The nuclear capacity will give you that insurance policy. As I say, if you have nuclear capacity, then you can go as crazy as you want, and people can be upset and angry, but they can't come to your capital with an infantry division and hang you in the street because you have nuclear weapons. Yeah, it's a good insurance policy. That is my view, and it remains my view. Having said that, we should not ignore, nevertheless, the presence within the circles of the Iranian regime of some very extreme eschatological, I hope you have the same word in German, right? Eschatological religious thinking. Especially among the younger people in IRGC, which I've read about, this idea of Mahdist political thinking, the notion that you can bring about the return of the Mahdi, you know, who went into occultation many centuries ago, through political action, among which would be the destruction of the return of Muslim control of Jerusalem, for example. So this really quite crazy, really very extreme religious ideas are also existing in the Iranian system, but they are not, in my view, dominant. They exist, and we should not also forget about them. Yeah. So So I think that's really done.
We made the whole tour. Thank you so much, Jonathan Spire.
Thank you.
And thanks again for the cooperation partners, the Junge Forum from the Deutsch-Israelische Gesellschaft. Daniel Runkel is here. If you might be a member of the Junge Forum, go to him. And Oliver Bradley from APA. Thank you so much for the cooperation. Please look out for the usual channels on Facebook, on our website, or from the UFO for the next events. We will be here regularly again at the Humboldt University to do some events on the region, on Israel, on Iran. Please come again. Thank you for being here. Have a nice way.
I just have also one question. First of all, I was filming this. Don't worry, it's not going to be public. It's just going to go to our donors.
Just to the Iranian embassy.